Coming up on Tech News Today, we talked to Dan Gooden from Ars Technica about how passwords have never been weaker, what you can do about it. Also, Google on the ropes in iOS a little bit, and our next trip to Mars. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, August 21st, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TNT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your iPhone, iPad, MacBook, or Android smartphones from your home or office. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting off each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feeds. Now, those of you tired of the Samsung Apple patent case, I'm thinking of Judge Koh, actually, should be happy to know the closing arguments are done and it's headed to jury, doing jury instructions right now as we record. Apple CEO Tim Cook and Samsung Corporate Strategy Chief Ji-Sung Choi had a nice chat yesterday, but they didn't resolve anything. The jury must reach a unanimous verdict on 84 jury instructions. Samsung's got alleged infringement of 7 Apple patents to deal with, as well as counterclaims that Apple infringed 5 Samsung patents. Those of you who love patent cases, I'm thinking of lawyers?
No, they don't love me either.
Should know that a separate Samsung-Apple case is moving ahead in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington.
Microsoft's Windows 8 Pro software has a price, and that price is $199, following a $69.99 promotional price that expires on January 1st, 2013, according to a source speaking to The Verge. For those upgrading from Windows 8 to Windows 8 Pro in retail stores, the price is the same, $69.99, until that January 31st date, when the price reverts to $99.99. Both the Windows 8 and Windows 8 Pro and Windows 8 Pro copies will be made available from retailers on October 26th.
Canon's introduced two new cameras, the SX160IS and the SX500IS, are both 16-megapixel cameras that launch in September. Canon's bragging about the zoom ability of both cameras. The 160 has a 16x optical zoom, and the SX500 has a 30 times optical zoom, so that's pretty impressive. These are point-and-shoot cameras, so they're still supposed to be able to fit in your hand. The SX160 will cost about $230. The 500 costs $330.
Everything Everywhere is a joint venture in the UK of Deutsche Telekom and France Telecom. The company promotes both Orange and T-Mobile brands in the UK. So to simplify things, the company announced its new LTE service will launch soon with a brand new name. So now they'll have 4 names. Right alongside Orange and T-Mobile, Everything Everywhere will market LTE under whatever they decide to call it.
Yesterday, a post on TechCrunch titled, Apple is not the most valuable company in the history of the world, made the point that while the $661 billion market cap is impressive for Apple, with inflation in account, IBM remains the historic winner with a 1967 value of $1.3 trillion. But the article was citing the Columbia Journalism Review, and that was incorrect. IBM's market cap in today's dollars is $192.3 billion. Microsoft is number one when you actually account for inflation correctly. Its market cap was actually about $856 billion in constant dollars, $235 billion more than Apple's current market cap, which means people are still rich.
Yes. Yeah. Good. And my brain hurts.
Wait, I'm not.
It looks like Radio Shack is entering the wireless.
Not everyone.
Looks like Radio Shack's entering the wireless business. Engadget published a screenshot of a Radio Shack announcement heralding the arrival of its Radio Shack No Contract Wireless service to be powered by Cricket Wireless. The announcement also says that if you go with Radio Shack, you'll get access to Move Music, which is supposed to give you unlimited full song downloads. It's supposed to launch in September 5th.
Barnes & Noble lost $41 million in Q2, but that was good news because it was down from $57 million for the same period last year. The closing of competitor Borders probably boosted retail sales a bit, as did booming sales of 50 Shades of Grey, according to Barnes & Noble. Digital results were mixed. Online sales fell 7.6%, but not for e-books. Digital content rocketed up 46%. The Nook business remained flat.
U.S. District Judge William Alsup, who oversaw the Oracle versus Google lawsuit, wants to know who specifically Google may have paid to write about the trial. Google previously produced a general list of types of people at universities, grant recipients, Google employees, even bloggers that get money from the search giant and would have been in a position to comment on the case. In a court document filed last Friday, Google denied paying any of these individuals to write about the case. But that's not good enough for Alsup, who wrote that as it stands, Google hasn't complied with his order.
Microsoft opened up 500,000 registrations for the company's Xbox Live Fall Dashboard Beta program today. Aspiring testers must agree to a non-disclosure agreement to participate in the testing. First round of registrations back in July filled up in hours, so these go quick. The update gets you the new Internet Explorer for Xbox app, additional languages for Bing voice search, Xbox Music, and a new Play 2 option for streaming from Windows 7 and Windows 8.
Your phone's going to be able to talk to your refrigerator. Panasonic has created its own Panasonic Smart app for Android that will let users control their air conditioners, washers and dryers, and other compatible devices like refrigerators. The app is free and hits Japan at the end of the summer. At the end of September, Panasonic did not announce when this tech is hitting the rest of the world. So, Japan, you get to live in the future.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by ShareFile by Citrix. I use this a lot with my accountant. You're constantly collaborating with colleagues and clients. You're sharing files like contracts, spreadsheets, presentations, sensitive information. And it's essential that these files are kept safe, secure, and under your control. That's why we use ShareFile by Citrix. The easy-to-use business solution allows you to exchange files quickly but also securely. So it's easy for the person on the other end to get your file, but you know when they got it, whether it was just them that got it. And that's what I do. I like the fact that I can tell if someone really did open the attachment or not. With ShareFile, you can send files of almost any size, no bounce backs, control who has access to those files, the level of permission they have, whether they have write access, you can do some collaboration, or just read access. It syncs automatically, so you and your team always have the most updated materials, and you can access ShareFile from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, your smartphone, do some work on the go. It has lots of side benefits besides just sending the attachments along. So I want you to try ShareFile with our special offer. Sign up today and receive a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TNT. Remember, visit ShareFile.com, type in this promo code TNT. And we thank Citrix and ShareFile for their support of Tech News Today. All right, let's dig a little deeper into some of the stories going on today. And I want to start by bringing in Dan Gooden from Ars Technica. He's the IT security editor there. Thanks for joining us today, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed it's great to have you. I really enjoyed your article on why passwords have never been weaker and crackers have never been stronger. I think in the wake, especially of the hacking of Matt over at Wired, this is top of mind for a lot of people, how to properly protect themselves. Give us a little summary. It's a long article. It's well worth reading, but give us a little summary of what you found here.
Well, the article kind of tracks how in the last, you know, 5 or so years, we've reached this inflection point where, you know, literally the average password of 2012 is significantly weaker than the average password of 2005 or 2000 or 1995. And that inflection point we reached through a sort of confluence of factors, you know, not the least of which is this huge corpus, literally hundreds of millions of real world passwords that have been dropped into the public domain. And with every single one of those, crackers get a slightly better insight into how all of us choose passwords that are somewhat memorable to us, but we hope are hard for other people to guess. And so, you know, when we had 10 million of these, it was bad. And when we had 30 million, it got worse. And, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 million, it's just this snowball effect where crackers are suddenly able to crack a large percentage, maybe 60% of the hashes that get dumped with just doing a cut and paste exercise.
Yeah.
So that's confluence number one. But then you, at the same time, you have things like GPUs that for very cheaply you can add to your PC, and you can literally crack, you know, maybe do 8 billion attempts per second. And so you have this whole confluence of factors that is just making your password significantly weaker on average than just a few years ago.
Yeah, I like the fact that you brought out it's not just the brute forcing. I mean, you mentioned that PC running an AMD Radeon HD 7970 gets that 8.2 billion passwords each second ability. You combine that with something like OCL Hashcat Plus, and pretty much anybody can do this. But it's not even just the brute forcing. So, you know, the response to that is, well, I'll create a more complicated password. But even then, if you're using a technique that is common, because of what you just mentioned, the fact that the hackers can go out there and look at these hashed passwords that have been leaked, find out what they are and see patterns. That is where it gets fascinating, because I liked your example about Julia 1984. That would take 19 days to brute force unless you already know the proper names and years are a combination. And then you use something called a mask attack. It brings it down to 90 seconds.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, the average cracker these days, they might have, they have all kinds of, dictionary lists, as they call them. They're just word lists, they might take, they'll use different ones for different jobs, but they might take one, for 26 million passwords, because that's a nice nimble, believe it or not, 26 million is a nimble password list. And of course, included in that is going to be every single first name that has ever been scraped from Facebook. And so since we know now that, a large percentage of passwords are just a first name and a year, so Julia 1984 or Christopher 1965 or whatever, it's very trivial to have every single word in your dictionary, it's trivial to append every single, four number character combination to every single password in my list. And in very short order, I can get, anyone that ever uses their first name and a birth date is automatically going to be, it's going to fall prey to attack like this.
Now, I recommend, again, folks read the article. You go into explanations of rainbow tables, the importance of websites salting passwords, using secure hashing algorithms. You point out that SHA-1, MD5, DES, those are crackable. And you're encouraging websites to use more secure passwords, but on our or more secure methods of encryption. But on our end, the folks making the passwords, you had some good advice in there for people on how to pick a password that is less likely to be cracked.
Yes, absolutely. So there are all kinds of ways that people pick passwords, and the vast majority of them are not nearly as secure as people think. And so really, the password experts that I have spoken to, they all have slightly different advice on what to do, but almost all of them agree that one of the things that the average person can do that will make a huge difference is to never, ever choose their password themselves. That is, even when I think I'm picking something that is random, chances are it's got an awful lot of patterns built into it. And so once people learn a little bit about me, they're going to be able to figure out how I choose a password. Well, if I get something like Password Safe or one password or one of these other password managers, I can tell that program to pick a 13, 14, 15 character password that truly is random. That is, by definition, is a randomly chosen password. And that is probably the biggest defense anyone is ever going to have to preventing the types of attacks that my article kind of talks about and chronicles.
Yeah, because a couple of people in our chat room are saying, well, as long as they're properly secured on the other end, that's all that matters. But even hashed passwords, if they're salted and they're using better encryption, maybe you're right. But even hashed passwords can be reverse engineered. Or if a table has been leaked, and they know, well, this kind of password makes this kind of hash, and you're using the same password as somebody else out there, your password's no longer secure. So you not even just have to make it unique from your other websites, but you need to make it unique from everyone else on the internet.
That's correct. And I mean, it's a little bit funny, people in these in the chat room saying, well, all that needs to happen is these things need to be properly secured. I mean, how many times recently have we seen things properly secured? We certainly didn't see that with LinkedIn. We certainly didn't see that with eHarmony. Even HB Gary, which was protecting you know, passwords that belong to Henry Kissinger and very well-known, you know, people, they didn't use any kind of salting. They didn't use a secure algorithm. So assuming that people are storing these things, you know, properly is a huge stretch. And all it takes is one of these guys to leak my password. And if I use that anywhere else, I'm now really screwed. So I think that the best thing all of us can do is to assume that our passwords are not going to be stored correctly.
Yeah.
And if I pick a 13 character password that is randomly generated, has never been used on any other site before, there is a strong likelihood that even if a hash table that contains that password, it's going to take a real, that password is going to be in the 10% of passwords that still aren't cracked after, you know, 4, 5, 6 days. And that buys me time to change that password after a website does something irresponsible or suffers a web breach. As soon as I'm using a password that has been, is included in this corpus of 100 plus million passwords, you know, my password is going to fall within the first hour or day. And so that's the difference is no matter what, my password is going to be cracked if there's a breach. But if I have taken the proper steps, I can make sure that my password is in that high percentile, that, you know, that 10% that takes days to crack rather than in the 90% that takes hours to crack.
I like using LastPass. You mentioned 1Password is another good one. There's a bunch of good ones for managing those. And you think that that's a wise idea? Some people are leery of storing all their passwords in someone else's database.
Well, that's exactly right. So you're never going to find absolute agreement. You know, there is the problem with any of these types of passwords that I'm now these password managers, is that I'm now storing all of my passwords in a single place. I'm using a single master password to unlock those. So if a adversary gets that file and that adversary gets my master password, I now I have literally dozens of accounts that are vulnerable. And so that is a problem. It's not a silver bullet. There are risks that are unique to that type of model that don't happen with some of the other ways that people recommend. But on the whole, I mean, if I'm using only 3 passwords to access all of my accounts, there's also a single point of failure there. So, at the very least, if I'm using multiple passwords, let's say I literally have 60 different passwords for every single account I ever use, that means that if Twitter does something irresponsible, if LinkedIn does something irresponsible, if any one of these sites does something irresponsible, I've only lost my Twitter account. I haven't, you know, I mean, what we saw with Matt Honan was that so many of his accounts were intertwined that once somebody had, you know, something as simple as 4 digits of a credit card number from Amazon, then that information was allowed, you know, was all that the hackers need to get into, you know, the iCloud account. Once you get into the iCloud account, you can, you know, literally permanently wipe, you know, data from a, you know, hard drive or do a lot of other scary things. So on the whole, the people I spoke with, I think people came to the conclusion that was probably the best measure. It's not the only measure. And some people are going to say that using something, you know, like a password manager does create a single point of failure. They're absolutely correct. But I think on the balance, I think that's probably the way to go.
Yeah, it's all about a balancing the risks out. You're never going to get 100%. Dan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today and for writing up that article. It's an important thing for people to not only know themselves, but to pass along to their friends and relatives. As passwords get weaker and weaker, it's more and more important until we come up with some other system to make secure passwords.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on today.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Dan, IT security editor at Ars Technica, arstechnica.com. We'll have a link in the show notes to his article at twit.tv/TNT. All right, let's move on to Google changing how many results they're showing.
Yeah, forget passwords. Google's dropping the number of results on their first page, which is a highly coveted area for SEO. No, this is actually, I love search engine land for this very reason, because this is one of the many things that Danny Sullivan kind of obsesses over, so that it ends up being interesting information for the rest of us. Google is testing a move from 10 results on its first page when you search for anything to 7. Now, it's not going to show up for just for everything that you search for. Again, it's just a test. But it appears to be results that will also end up adding site links that appear under listings. So, for example, if you search for search engine land, you will get searchengineland.com as the first result. But under that first result, before you get some of the others, which is like Search Engine Land's Twitter page, Google Plus page, you get a variety of articles that Danny and his team have written recently. On right under those results. Now, that is just sort of an expanded result from the result number one. Now, that might be helpful to you or might not. I mean, you might just be looking for the blog, and you might actually be looking for particular articles. Now, they also highlight eBay. Now, eBay is actually a better example. Jason, if you scroll up just a tiny bit where we can see result number one, we see eBay.com. Then we actually see some of the popular categories within eBay. So that's just a big, fat, expanded number one result. Under that number one result, we also see news for eBay. That's not actually counted as result number two, because that's something that appears in Google search results. It's kind of its own thing. They call it Google Universal Search. So images, news, those are extra as far as the results go. Now, you might say, well, I don't know, this just sort of seems like it is more organized and gives me more information. And that's actually what I think Google's probably working towards. It's not so much like eBay wants to push its competitors off of the main page.
Although they would.
That's not why.
Yeah, I mean, this is not like eBay's forcing Google to make any changes. A little bit more of like a Google, if it has a strong enough algorithm, figures because of the way that people search, and if it's doing its job correctly, number one probably is what you're searching for. But maybe within that domain, you actually were searching for the auto section of eBay. So let's just give you that link. And maybe the news area is, you know, that much more helpful. This is something that Search Engine Land, by the way, got from SEO Moz, who used a prediction tool to kind of drill down into some of this data and figure out how many results have 7 rather than 10 results on the first page. And they have a set of queries, and they crunch data on a variety of search engine results pages, which they call SERPs. Google had a statement in response to this article saying, listen, we're working out the best ways to show multiple results from a single site when it's clear that users are interested in that site, blah, blah, blah. But I figure, well, what's really the point? I mean, is it just organization? Do we feel like there's anything else going on here?
I mean, pushing those last three, instead of having 10 and only having 7 links up there as search results, I could see a lot of people that were just on the cusp of that first page getting very annoyed. The thing is, I don't know how often you start clicking to the second page or the third page of results on Google. By the time you're at the fifth page, you're pretty desperate. You're going to redo your search because, you know,
exactly. The
quality drops off really far, really fast. So the thing is, it's those people who are working on their SEO enough and they're just on the front page, now they're getting bumped off. So that, I could see ruffling some feathers there. But, I mean, Google's got to show you the results you want. And I know I've done searches like this and seen this expanded result on the top, and it's usually what I want anyway. I just forget what subdomain it is, and it shows up that way. So I'm quite liking this from what I've experienced.
I'm slowly learning to pay attention to those sub-results because I'm just used to ignoring everything that's below the actual result. And every once in a while, I find myself wanting to find like the locations of a retail store, for instance, and just clicking on the main link, even though I see that locations is down there, because I just don't trust that it's going to work. I've been burned before.
Well, you know what I also do? Sometimes when there's a company or a service or I'm trying out an app, it's like I just want to know a little bit more about the company, like who's the co-founder or this or that. So you go to the domain, then you scroll to the bottom of the page and you try to find the about area. And I love it when the about area search
just shows up
in the Google search results, because that's actually what I'm looking for. It's a small thing, but it does save me time, and it does seem more well-organized.
All right, let's move on to the Barnes & Noble results we talked about in the news fuse. They're losing less money, but it seems to be because of retail sales. E.L. James 50 Shades of Grey is what Barnes & Noble says has boosted things for them. But what caught my eye is digital sales doing well, right? They're selling lots of e-books, but Nook sales are flat. And we know that they've talked about spinning out the Nook business as a separate business. Microsoft is investing some money in that spin-out business. Is that a good idea, though? Has Nook gone from being brilliant from Barnes & Noble to being a dead weight?
I doubt it's a dead weight. At this thing, right now, the competition is heating up. Enough rumors of another Kindle versions coming out. I mean, Barnes & Noble's just cut the prices on their Nook tablets to be competitive at this point, because they're kind of long. It was a while that the Nook tablet was the Android tablet people loved because it was low cost, it was easy to get, and right now there's so much competition with the Nexus 7 showing up, and it basically outspecked it. Like, it's got some great specs, and people, well, learners like me like that over the Nook, because you don't have to bother, oh, I can root this and I can change the operating system to have a full experience, or I can just go over here. I think when Barnes & Noble refreshes the Nook, this will change entirely, because right now the flat sales are because everyone who wants a Nook has one.
Jason, what does Barnes & Noble need to do to capture the Android fans here? There's the Nexus 7. There's, you know, there's an iPad Mini coming out people could use as an e-reader.
You might don't be, know I'm that, inexpensive. Tom.
I said might be coming out.
Okay.
If I'm an Android fan and I don't even want to consider that iPad,
right?
What does Barnes & Noble have to do to catch my eye?
I mean, I think, like you were saying, as the Nexus 7 comes along and you know, swiftly takes the lead as far as Android tablets in this particular category are concerned, Nook was always kind of second to the Kindle Fire, even though many people said that it was even better, you know, for many different reasons. They have to come out with comparable hardware if they want to compete, I think, because even when you look at the ecosystem, just in general, the ecosystem for Google, you know, with the 7 is pretty good. Same for the Amazon Kindle. Probably could be debated by some people. But Barnes & Noble, just, I don't know if they're necessarily known for having a strong ecosystem. So that puts them behind even further. So their hardware has to compete in order for them to be in the same table. I think ultimately, though, they're probably going to be third place, again, at least as far as Android tablets are concerned in that category.
Yeah, I kind of think they have to blow people away. I mean, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, the Nook Color tablet was a better tablet than the Kindle Fire, but everyone bought the Kindle Fire. Because of the ecosystem. And Barnes & Noble has an ecosystem. I mean, Sarah, can they win?
I don't think that. I think Barnes & Noble would have such a long way to go to make the Nook seem like as powerful as a tablet and a computer, really, as the Nexus 7. I still think of Nook. Oh, yeah, it's an e-reader. That's, yeah. that's what it is.
They have to do something different. They have to market it as a tablet.
Their branding is very strong as far as reading goes. Mm-hmm. But I don't really see them having a very good strategy here.
I smell.
You're doomed.
I smell rim.
You're doomed.
No, I don't think it's that bad. I mean, the
just
thing
a
is,
whiff.
All Barnes & Noble needs is a bunch of. They need content partners, right? I mean, if it's just books, that's fine. But the thing is, the tablet does more than that. You want to watch videos. You want to listen to music. And what Barnes & Noble did with the Nook and locking, they locked people out of the internal storage because they want you to buy Barnes & Noble stuff. You get 1 gigabyte for your own. I think you get like 15 for Barnes & Noble content, but they don't have a whole lot of video content, and that's hurting them. Yeah. Once they line up those deals, maybe.
If they line up those. All right, let's take a quick break. Thank our sponsor, Gazelle. Lots of gadgets. We just talked about a bunch of them coming out this fall, and you need some money if you want to get in on some of that action. One of the ways to get money simply and easily is to use Gazelle. I do it all the time. I take those old gadgets, your old iPhones, your old iPads, your MacBooks, your old Android phones. Go to gazelle.com. It's so fast. It's so simple. You just type in G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You put in fact, they give you a visual representation of stuff now. It's easier than ever. Sometimes you don't even have to type. You got an iPad third generation or a second generation. You just click on it. Tell them which brand. Is it AT&T? Is it Verizon? They'll get you right to an offer quickly. And here's the thing. Once you get that offer, it's locked in for 30 days. So if you're saying, well, I want to wait because I'm not sure I'm going to sell that phone until I know I'm going to get a new phone, if you're pretty sure that phone's coming out, you can lock it in right now for 30 days. In fact, I think sometimes it's more. And then once you're ready to sell it, once the announcement of that Motorola Razr comes out that you want, you can go ahead and print out that shipping label. They'll pay for the shipping, send off your old gadget, and you'll get paid fast. You can get paid by check or PayPal, or you choose an Amazon gift card. You actually get 5% bonus when you do that. Payment's fast. You get it within a few days, and offers, like I said, are good for 30 days. So here's what you do. Go take a minute. Go to gazelle.com. Find out how much your gadget is worth and do it now, because the sooner you do, the more money your gadgets will be worth. Sell your used iPhones, iPads, Macs, and other smartphones today at gazelle.com. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. I got another Google story, but this one isn't such a positive one. It's about how Google no longer being the default for things on iOS might not be such good news for them, but good news for third parties.
Yeah, well, this is a great infographic, actually, that I was studying on MacStories.net earlier today. And it's more really a timeline of iOS from iOS 1. iPhone OS is what I believe they called it at first, because there wasn't anything to compare it to. And how at the beginning, it was all Google and Yahoo. I mean, Apple didn't even have an app store at the time in the first generation of iOS. So they had things like Yahoo Search and Yahoo Weather and Google Maps and YouTube all adding data into iOS, because Apple knew that that was what people equated with the web and mm-hmm. services to trust. And it seems like such a long time ago, but it really wasn't. By the time iOS 2 came around, they introduced Microsoft Exchange support. They introduced their App Store. So then it was a little bit of, hey, you can make your phone whatever you want to. There's an app for that. All of that good stuff kind of happened around that time. iOS 3 was somewhat uneventful, but by the time iOS 4 rolled around, you get into Bing support. So it's sort of like, okay, all right. Apple's not playing.
I've got a search engine choice.
Yeah, Apple and Google aren't, there's no exclusivity here. The relationship's starting to see some signs of cracking. iTunes Ping, we all know where that went. Facebook
hey,
integration
I was
went
just
sour
using
around
it
that
the
time.
Other day.
Were you?
Yes.
For what?
I'm a Ping fan.
Are you?
And I'm not ashamed to say it.
So you just like hanging out alone then?
No, there's like, five or six other people I talk
okay.
to.
Okay, it's a small dinner party. You're just not, you know.
Don't make fun.
You don't want to go to the kegger. You want to go to the civilized
yes, exactly,
small party.
Exactly.
We have a few extra chairs. Facebook integration around the time of iOS 4 went south. Then by the time we got to iOS 5, you get Twitter integration. And, you know, markedly not a Facebook integration, but you've got Twitter. And then you've got Siri. And at this point, Siri is really interesting, because you think of it as, oh, Siri is Apple's new thing. You know, it's your robot the lady and your phone and everything. Yeah. But Siri is not a product that was created by Apple, although they did make a lot of their own changes to it when they bought the company behind it. But also Siri pulls from all sorts of third-party apps and adding them all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. not only Wolfram Alpha, but Yelp and sports data and the list goes on. So it's really turned into such a big third-party app infrastructure. Google, of course, is one of the companies that loses out the most. Obviously, as of recently, not only is Google Maps going by the wayside, but YouTube is also out. And this is, of course, just part of the native iOS experience. And I think that we've debated that Google's probably better off. Maps, we'll have to see what kind of a product that Apple's able to roll out. But as far as YouTube goes, it's probably better as a third-party app. Google can watch it more closely. They can push out updates more closely. But now with iOS 6, we've got Facebook back in. Apple and Facebook now are playing nicely again.
They worked it out. They hugged it out.
They're going to have native Facebook support just as much as they have Twitter. And then a huge integration of Chinese services. Baidu, Youku, Tudo, Sina Weibo.
You
got one of them.
Let's go with that
right.
one.
Thank
sure.
you. Yeah. You guys have heard of it. That's obviously where Apple is going. They're wanting to have partnerships with big enough companies, but not Google, I guess.
It is interesting that they're actually, I mean, Google is still your default search engine on Safari, and I think it'll stay that way. I don't see that going away. But otherwise, there's no formal partnership.
If they were to strip that out, it would seem very childish, kind of schoolyard stuff. Because Google search is the... It is
the most popular search engine.
Yeah, if you didn't have that choice.
I mean, given the boot to YouTube, the app, I think, is a little strange. But, I mean, when looking at the evolution of iOS, it just seems like Apple does this very slow integration with these kinds of partners, because it looks like they were trying to figure out how exactly to do this. Because once you, like today, if you have your iOS device and you hit share, you get like 40 options. And then how do you display all of these things at once? Because that was not a normal thing. I mean, you had to figure out, okay, well, there's share to Twitter, share to this, share to that. They had to change the menus up. So there's a whole lot of learning that has to go on. Like, okay, first, here's your phone. This is what it's like now. And here's an app store. So you do the small building. It's a lot of learning you got to do. If you think about iOS 1, you're like, okay, this is a phone? This is interesting. And now what it can do is based on years of learning that Apple's been pushing. So I think they figured out with Siri how to integrate so many different things on the back end that you don't have to think about. Mm. That's the big thing. You're not like, well, how do I just go to Rotten Tomatoes? Do I have to do this? And you just hold the button down.
You call it learning. Android fans probably call it hand-holding.
Yes.
Because that's one of the benefits of Android is you're not limited to what you can integrate and what you can share. You get to pick what is integrated, what the sharing options are, what's in that long menu item, which is both a bigger deal if you're the kind of person who gets easily confused by that, but also better because you can winnow it down and say, okay, well, I only want these options and I don't want Facebook in there. I want Google Plus or I've got the choice of where Rotten Tomatoes shows up in my system, but you also have to maintain it or it gets out of hand really fast.
Apple's big into hand holdings. Like, we're going to lock down your computer. We're going to removable batteries anymore. Nothing like that. So that's about right.
It's not just hand holding. It's Apple trying to, I don't want to use the word manipulation, but I mean, that's actually exactly what it is. It's like they're stripping out branding of other services because it's so seamless within iOS, right? I mean, you're using Yelp, but if you can use Apple services without really thinking about using Yelp, then Apple wins because then Apple feels stronger, more powerful.
This is only tangentially related to what we're talking about, but I would like to call on the websites of the world to stop reminding me every time I go to your website that you have an app that I could use instead of your website.
That's if a new feature.
Maybe once and then set a cookie and be done with it. But like every time I go to The Verge, every time I go to Yelp, every time I go to TripIt, hey, wouldn't you rather be using the app? No, I want to use the freaking browser. I don't want to have 5,000 apps for everything out there.
Apple even said it with the iOS 6 introduction that there would be a feature that you can have a banner on the top saying that you have an app in the store instead of those pop over things that get so annoying. So that's a feature because it's so
PC hated. Mag today not only gave me the wouldn't you rather use the app? No, because I'm going to read this story later through Chrome Sync on my desktop, but then went from there to a please subscribe to our magazine on the tablet. Like, I had to go through two layers to get to the freaking story. Then it gave me a tablet version, which is fine. But then when I synced that over to Chrome on my desktop later, the tablet version was like, oh, you can't watch this on the desktop. You have to get the desktop version. Click here. Just, you're trying to be too clever out there. We got a couple more stories to discuss. Radio Shack getting into the wireless service business.
Yeah, this rumor's been floating around a bit, but Engadget published a screenshot of a memo. And like I said in the news for you, September 5th is when this is supposed to launch, so it'll be around when the Nokia world starts and Motorola's got announced, but that same day. So September 5th is going to be a fun day.
It's a big day.
But it's going to be powered by Cricket Wireless, the Radio Shack wireless service, and it looks like it's just prepaid phones. No contracts. No more contracts at all. So Radio Shack has they cut out T-Mobile as a partner. They don't have T-Mobile phones in their stores anymore. They still have Verizon devices. So there's really no reports as to what's going to happen with what offerings they'll have as phones. But it seems like the more companies that get involved with being MVNOs effectively, no more contracts, I think there's a good chance that people might start looking at prepaid phones as a real thing instead of it like, oh, it's just another option. But, like, I think this kind of, if everybody goes to Radio Shack, which I don't know, I used to go to that when I was, like, a kid. But, I mean,
I bought an OTA antenna from there the other day.
Do you think it can popularize a bit the information about prepaid phones? Instead of going, okay, I'm going to go to the heavily subsidized phone and be locked down. Do you think this is going to help push?
You mean because Radio Shack is a long-standing, respected brand? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't think of Radio Shack in that way. I mean, I guess I think of Radio Shack more as like a little bit more old school hardware. I had to buy a phone, like a landline phone the other day, and I'm like, Radio Shack will have it. Type of thing. It's not what they want me to think, no. But I was right.
Right.
Sears. Right, exactly. But I like the idea of prepaid plans. I don't know. I mean, I think that they... We talk so much about how these companies screw us over with these, you know, subsidized prices and high monthly fees and why, you know, the AT&T and Verizon don't really want us to know about these plans because they're probably going to end up looking more attractive to a lot of people and then they lose out on more money in the end. So, yeah, it's smart of Radio Shack to get into this game. I guess it's just, can they market what they offer well enough so that people realize that it could be a really good solution for that?
It's a natural evolution, I think. And we think of Radio Shack as the place where you go to buy resistors and adapter wires. They have been marginalizing that. In fact, they don't even sell a lot of those electronics components that they used to anymore. They are front and center a cell phone retailer. That is the first thing you see when you walk into any Radio Shack these days. And it must be working for them because they've been doing it for years. So I feel like this makes sense for them to say, you know what? The marketplace is moving to prepaid. We're going to have to move there with it. And it smacks a little bit of the old Tandy days when you'd buy realistic branded electronics at Radio Shack way back in the 80s. Everything was branded for Tandy through Radio Shack with the realistic brand. I kind of wish they would call this the realistic cell phone service.
Whatever happened to the Shack? I know.
Yeah, really.
That marketing plan ended. They never actually changed the name of the company. Or the stores.
Okay.
That was just a marketing thing. I think it's finally gone away. At least I hope it has.
Maybe
it hasn't.
I don't like it.
Let's go to Mars.
Yeah, let's finish up with Mars. So Mars Curiosity rover continuing to pump out all kinds of cool stuff. The laser was tested on a rock to see how the spectrometer worked. There's lots of cool things happening every day. But we're already looking ahead to the next Mars mission.
Yeah, NASA announced it's sending a new probe to Mars. It's called the InSight, and InSight stands for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations. How do you say this word? Geodesy and heat transport. So effectively, it's going to be checking out the inside of Mars by drilling. So it's going to use seismic instruments.
Mars mole men are not going to like that.
Yeah, this is. I'm going to get to that in a minute. It's going to use a powerful drill, and it's going to be finding out information about Mars's shape, rotational wobble, internal temperature, and density. So you get more of a picture because the probes that are already out there, the Curiosity, they do surface chemistry. So you're finding out what the surface is like. But the more information you can find out about Mars, there's a good chance that maybe one day, far-flung future, if it's possible, it could be habitable. Like, we can colonize this thing. But if there are Mars men in there, they must be really annoyed that we're just throwing things at them. Now we're drilling in 2016 into their planet.
Drill, baby, drill. Mars, that is.
Yeah, that's fine. Not in my backyard, but on Mars you can.
Someone in chat said frack Mars. I don't think you're going to find oil. There probably hasn't been enough life there. But, yeah, so 2016 this launches in March?
In March 2016, and it lands on September 20th. So it's got a long way to go. I'm just very curious about what exactly we're going to get out of this information. Like, if we find out there's enough resources on Mars, are we going to start mining it? Or are we going to start moving there?
Well, it's all about, this is the thing, right? A lot of people criticize, like, what good is any of this? And the thing is, we don't really know. That's what science is about, is exploration. You don't go across the ocean to try to find a new continent because you know one's already there. You go because you think one might be there and you want to see what it's like and what advantages it would have. And I think that's what we're doing with Mars, is we're sending these robots, we're sending these probes because we want to find out. We have questions like, hey, it might be habitable, might have water, might have had life at some point, or maybe still does. Let's go and explore that and find out. And this is another way of expanding your base of information, right? Sending a robot that goes down and travels in a couple mile circle gives you a lot of information, but only on a small area and only on the surface area. So, yeah, it makes sense to go underground and say, okay, let's see whether Mars has still got any kind of seismic activity, and if so, what? What kind of things exist underground? I think this is great. I'm excited about it. Let's move on to the randomizer.
Randomizer.
And as you know, folks, it is an election year, and so we really encourage you to go out and vote for the Robot Hall of Fame. Carnegie Mellon, of course, is the institution giving you the election for the Robot Hall of Fame.
I didn't know that was coming. I'm sorry.
You didn't know the randomizer was coming?
I knew the randomizer was coming. I didn't know that the election was coming.
Oh, no. You don't have to do the election coverage. I'm just hoping you would show the
Carnegie
Mellon.
Yeah, no. Okay. I thought you were cueing me for something else. I'm like, I don't have it.
There you go. So what's going on is you can vote in four different categories: education, consumer robots, entertainment robots, industrial and service robots, and research robots. And one from every one of those will show up in the Robot Hall of Fame once the voting is done. I think when does voting end?
Voting ends, let's see.
The induction ceremony is October 23rd. I think you have till late in September to do the voting. Previous winners have been C-3PO, R2-D2, Gort, Astro Boy, Asimo.
Yeah, but you can get an iRobot in there. If you want to get a Roomba in there, you can vote for the Roomba. I like the Roomba.
It's not the Roomba, though. It's different.
Create was designed
like the by iRobot.
Yeah, it's called Create. They make...
Isn't it a little unfair that fictional robots are going up against actual helpful vacuum cleaner robots?
Right. It would be if they were going up against. But as I mentioned, there are different categories. So when you vote, you only vote within the category.
Right.
You
so can it's a choose, little bit of fantasy robot.
You can choose to vote for Big Dog and Create from iRobot.
It's a robot love fest.
This is a hard one. They got Wall-E versus Rosie the robot from the Jetsons and Johnny Five.
Wall-E wins, obviously.
Rosie the robot should be in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, Rosie in the Hall of Fame.
Because
oh,
she's like the original. She's like both the pre. I guess I have a theme. I like robots that clean things.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Wall-E.
Wall-E makes you cry, though.
Well, that's not a reason to vote for him.
He's
the Hall of Fame. He's
got
a rookie.
A robot with a heart.
That's like saying that, you know, one of the current San Francisco Giants should go in the Hall of Fame because he's awesome. You got to wait a while, you know? Previous players.
Legends
Rosie
are born
is a legend.
Every day, Tom.
That's true.
Like Mario, doesn't take a lifetime.
Mario Lemieux style rules. Like,
it doesn't
I'm
have to be a posthumous award just for robots.
Put them right in.
Well, maybe next year.
if you would like to vote, go to robothalloffame.org and you can get more information. Let's check the calendar.
Starting on August 28th, Jawbone is going to let you customize the grill and the caps to your jam box. You can mix and match between 13 grill and 9 cap colors, over 100 color combinations. This is only for the actual jam box, does not apply to the big jam box. But if you are what Jawbone calls an insider or a clout user, you have an inside track from August 21st through the 27th to customize an order before all those other people go in and steal your idea. You can say, I was first. Plants vs. Zombies sequel is coming in spring 2013. Dry those tears. You don't have to watch Wall-E anymore. It's going to be okay. You're going to be able to play Plants vs. Zombies, the sequel.
I actually really excited about that. I love Plants vs. Zombies. I've played it through like 4 or 5 times.
Well, and you finally kind of got it out of your system. So now they know that you're the perfect candidate to get back into it again.
But I have to wait till spring.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got a voicemail about newspapers versus Flipboard. And yes, we know about Pulse and all this, but let's listen to this voicemail.
AT&T crew, this is Adam. I listen to your show just about every morning on my way to work. I want to make a quick comment about Tom's comments about Flipboard versus a newspaper. And I think I know why he likes a newspaper better. A newspaper, especially when you open up to the front page, has a collection of stories that have been chosen by editors to have broad appeal, whereas Flipboard stories are pretty much based off of a Twitter feed or RSS or something like that. So it's just the latest stories that you're going to see from that particular blog or news service. So just thought that was an interesting point you guys might find interesting. And I don't know, enjoy the show. Have a great day.
Although your argument wasn't so much that Flipboard isn't as good as a newspaper, it's that you liked a physical newspaper more than you liked even a curated group of news stories on a tablet or on a laptop.
Yeah, Sandy, right down the road here in Novato, California, pointed out Pulse for iOS and Android devices, also with a new web interface. And yeah, that, you've exactly got it right, Sarah. All of these things, Pulse, Flipboard, you have to take action to go to. And I really wasn't saying I liked newspapers better. I just said it was kind of impressive when I picked up the newspaper and didn't have to do anything and information was there. I'd like to replicate that somehow, maybe with widgets on Android.
Widgets instant on when you're looking. Actually, the Samsung S3, when you look at it, it can tell when you're looking at it, so it should turn on and show you your news.
Exactly.
It kind of sounds like you want more notifications, and that sounds plumb crazy.
No, I definitely do not want more notifications. You're right. On to another email. This one from Vance.
Vance says, this is actually applies to the story from earlier about that Google court order. Vance says, many of the tech new outlets have a great headline today. Judge says that Google failed to comply with court order. This is about possibly paying bloggers to talk about its lawsuit with Oracle. The judge ordered both Google and Oracle to disclose those who might have been receiving payments from Google that might have been influencers on their behalf. Vance says, I think this is not a very well-worded request, definitely overbroad. If I recall, Google's response was that the request needed to be clarified and narrowed because responding to the broadest possible interpretation would result in a uselessly high number of names. It's normal to respond in a very narrow manner and request further clarification. Yes, that will result in a fail to comply response from the court, but it's just part of the process. I've had to do this myself on a couple of occasions.
Oh, really? Wow.
On a much smaller scale. So I think it can be a bit misleading when that quote is read out of context, since it makes it look as if Google was either snubbing the court or trying to hide something. Welcome to Tech Headlines.
Awesome. Vance, yeah. Thanks for the insight. Appreciate that.
A nice email from Aaron. AT&T, yesterday you were talking about what to call this hardware development surge coming out of Silicon Valley. I think it already has a name. The Internet of Things. While it's not a perfect name applied to an individual piece of hardware, all of these devices are either talking to the Internet directly or through your phone, a game console where you get your games on the Internet, a watch that talks to your phone, which is talking to the Internet, a little printer that outputs pictures, data from the Internet. All of these things are headless mini computers. I like that phrase, actually, that take their orders from the Internet. The folks down in the Valley aren't really changing their tune. They're still working on the Internet, just a different form.
Yeah, Internet of Things, probably the buzzword we're after there. Thanks, Rob. Watches, Nest, all of those are kind of the beginnings of that Internet of Things. So there you go. We've gone from Web 2.0 to Internet of Things.
Still like headless mini computers.
I think Rob called it.
Well, headless mini computer sounds awesome.
All right, that's it for this episode of Tech News Today. Thanks again to Dan Gooden from Ars Technica for joining us to talk about passwords. Of course, if you like that kind of discussion, definitely check out Security Now with Steve Gibson right here on this network, twit.tv/SN, or Thursday mornings at 11 a.m. Pacific. Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Pacific. Right. You'll end up with Windows Weekly if you go to Thursday, which is fine, but not what you want if you're looking for Security Now. You can also submit stories for our consideration at technewstoday.reddit.com. Thanks to everybody who goes in there and submits and votes. And that is it. You'll find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is tnt@twit.tv. And you can call us and talk to our voicemail box at 260-TNT Show. We'll be back with Lon Seidman tomorrow. See you then.
Oops. No, you know what that was? That was proof that what Tom does in between the end and the reason that you don't dance is because you're creating a... Yeah.
Oh, did you show this to you? That's pretty funny, actually. Yeah.
That's proof that you're creating a new page in the document.
No, I really am.
Yeah. See?
That's funny.
Realistic cell phones.
I'm glad I didn't have anything else up there.